Movie Buff Specials, Phil and John are back with episode number 96 of our favorite 100 films of all time, and we have hit the top five. That's right. There are only four episodes left after this. We have cracked the creme de la creme of all the creme de la cremes, because in the top 10, you thought we had hit good ones, but now we're in the top five, and there's just a better ring to that for some reason. We're talking The Master from 2012, and we're talking The Graduate from 1967. Graduate is the second newest movie out of either one of our top fives, and the second oldest movie out of any of our top fives, while The Master is the newest out of any of the movies in our top fives. So either we're just really pretentious, or we just like older movies more in our top five, even though we're littered with 20 teens movies all over the place. John, welcome. Thanks for making me watch The Master.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's a movie that like people kind of forgot about for a while. Came out in a weird year where it didn't garner as much attention as it totally should have. But I'm glad. I'm glad we watched it, because every time I watch this movie, I'm just reminded of how absolutely phenomenal the performances are in it. Because that's really what carries this movie. Like, yes, it's a PTA movie, and it feels like a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, especially as his follow-up to There Will Be Blood. But the performances are what carry this film.
Yeah, and before we hop into that, just talking about 2012 as a whole, right? Like, probably it was a good year for movies, but arguably one of the worst Oscar years ever. The Oscars just could not put their finger on anything that year. You had Argo win Best Picture without Ben Affleck being nominated for Best Director, which was like unheard of at that time. I think it only happened one or two times previously. I know Grand Hotel was one of them, but I don't remember the other. And then we had Ben Zeitlin getting a whole bunch of attention for Beasts of the Southern Wild. But this was the year with Moonrise Kingdom, which we talked about last week, 21 Jump Street, Skyfall, Francis Ha, the first Hobbit movie, Looper, Wreck-It Ralph, Ted, like The Place Beyond the Pines. We had Prometheus come out, Spring Breakers, like Sinister, Seven Psychopaths. I could keep going on and on. There's a lot of really good movies in this year, but the movies that garnered the critical attention when it came time to nominate for Oscars didn't make much sense. And so a movie like The Master, which is built around that premise of winning Oscars, as most Paul Thomas Anderson movies are, it was weird to see that it couldn't break through. Only got three Oscar nominations. It was actor, supporting actor, and supporting actress in a year where everything was pretty wide open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially when you consider the things that this probably should have been nominated for. Obviously, I think it should have been nominated for Best Picture. This is a year where I think they only had eight nominees for Best Picture, too. It was a weird one this year, right?
Yeah, it was when they were doing that, it could be anything. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It was nine. So there were nine that year. And I'm talking like, you had movies like Amour. Nobody talks about Amour anymore. Beasts of the Southern Wild. Nobody talks about Beasts of the Southern Wild anymore. Lincoln, which is such a bland retelling of history. It was a weird Best Actor or Best Picture nomination year. Yeah. And then you have Ben Zeitlin get the nomination over PTA, over Ben Affleck, over Tom Hooper for Les Mis, over Catherine Bigelow for Zero Dark Thirty. It's like, what movies were we all watching? I don't know how you feel about Beasts of the Southern Wild, actually. I don't know.
I haven't actually seen it. I haven't.
Okay. I am very low on that movie. That and Amour were huge disappointments. And I'm a huge Michael Haneke fan, and I don't know how to say his name. I always say it wrong. I did not like Amour at all. If you want to watch 2 hours of somebody dying, then that's the movie for you, but it's freaking miserable. And Beasts of the Southern Wild, I thought, was trying so hard to be something that it wasn't. And I feel like if it wasn't for Kwanzaa Wallace, nobody cares about that movie. And I know I just said her first name wrong, but I'm never going to say it right. But anyway, John, tell me why you put The Master in your top five somehow.
There's one incredibly easy answer to that. It's the processing scene.
Yeah, that scene's amazing.
That is, it's just the best scene ever put to film. In my opinion, it is one of the best acted scenes ever. It's the performance. You have two heavy hitting actors going at it in this film. You have Joaquin Phoenix, who's just continued to climb since this movie came out, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, who was always fantastic, never got the acclaim he deserved. And I mean, this is one of his last movies.
Yeah. Which we didn't realize was happening. But anyway, continue.
No, we didn't realize that was happening. But you get these incredible performances. Joaquin Phoenix as Freddy is... I guess Joaquin Phoenix has just gotten to the point where he plays really disturbing characters a lot of the time. And he does it so well. He just encapsulates this idea of this rage-filled man who... despite people reaching out and helping him, just doesn't want to be helped. And it's just this theme that's going on in this movie. And at the same time, you're watching Philip Seymour Hoffman play, I mean, the titular master. And he is so commanding of every single moment he's on screen. And they're exact opposite performances. I mean, it's perfectly shown in the jail scene in this movie, just like the difference between these two performances, but they're both so incredible. Obviously both did get the noms and both lost somehow.
Joaquin lost to Daniel Day-Lewis for Lincoln, which was just gonna happen, which is stupid. I mean, I thought Lincoln was terrible. Like legitimately, I hate Lincoln. I think it's so bad. And Daniel Day-Lewis just like dugs with a little bit of like a tiredness to him. And I'm like, who the hell cares? Philip Seymour Hoffman is the one that I think is unforgivable. I'm a huge Christoph Waltz fan. I thought he was phenomenal. Obviously, Inglourious Basterds. I mean, he's top notch. He didn't deserve the Oscar for Django. And like, I'm a lot lower on Django than a lot of people. I think it's one of the more overrated Quentin Tarantino movies. But I almost felt like they didn't know who to give it to that year, so they just gave it to him. If you look at the other noms, it was Christoph Waltz for Django, Alan Arkin for Argo, Robert De Niro for Silver Linings Playbook, Tommy Lee Jones for Lincoln, and then Philip Seymour Hoffman for The Master. I think what hurt Seymour Hoffman, because I think he's clearly the best one out of that group, what hurt him is people just didn't really watch his movie. And by this point, people had kind of cooled on PTA a little bit. Now, I know that's a weird thing to say because PTA just had Licorice Pizza come out. He got a whole bunch of nominations for that. He got a whole bunch of nominations for Phantom Thread, which wasn't the most popular movie in the world. But this was a strange time in the career of Paul Thomas Anderson, because he had done There Will Be Blood in 2007. And then it took him a little bit to put out a new movie, and the expectations were just too damn high. And that was the thing with this movie is the expectations on The Master, being that it was his first movie since There Will Be Blood. It was like, okay, this has to be perfect. And it was so much weirder than There Will Be Blood that people just like didn't really know how to react to it. It wasn't what they really wanted it to be. It wasn't what they thought it was going to be. It disappointed a lot of people. And the word of mouth on it wasn't as great in a year where I just listed off a bunch of movies.
Yeah.
There were a lot of movies to see. Even if the critically acclaimed ones, and by critically acclaimed, I mean nominated for Oscars ones, weren't all that great. There were a lot of movies that came out that year. I didn't even talk about The Hunt, also came out that year. Wasn't even nominated for Best Foreign Language Film because A Royal Affair got the Denmark nom instead, which is insane. You know, you had Brave when we're at the height of Pixar still, Wreck-It Ralph, Frankenweenie, Paranormal, like you had a lot of movies. You had a lot to go see. Flight came out that year, right? Yeah. And Denzel is a huge draw. And I didn't even talk about Life of Pi, which was also nominated for Best Picture, and Silver Linings Playbook was a huge success, and blah, 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 right down the line. So this kind of got lost in the shuffle. And I think it's why a movie like Moonrise Kingdom, which came out the same year, even though it barely got any Oscar nominations, it came out before the chaos. It came out at Cannes. And so everybody was able to kind of go out, see that movie, and then it built up a little bit of a clout, but it didn't have the big names attached to it in the leading roles that would pick up nominations. You weren't going to nominate Edward Norton or Bruce Willis, no matter how much they deserved it. So that being said, with The Master, I feel like it just got overlooked, and unrightfully so. Like, it did not deserve to be overlooked. And it just, once the word of mouth on it wasn't what it was for There Will Be Blood, that was it. Like, it really didn't have a shot. I've seen this. This is probably the third or fourth time I've seen this movie. I appreciate it more and more every time. Like, I think this movie is phenomenal. The acting is great. The message behind this is great. I always say this, like, you know, with the society we're in 2023, some of these movies that are set in the 50s, set in the 60s, they start to feel even more relevant now. Yeah. Because the master is just about being brainwashed, having no place to go. So you allow this man to brainwash you. And I feel like that happens all the time in our society. I mean, no matter what, like, no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, if you 100% believe either side of it, you're kind of just lost looking for somebody to believe 100%. And that's what this movie is. Like, this movie is just about, like, who am I? I have no identity, so I'm going to devoutly follow this one thing, wherever it may lead. And it's just a wild ride of a movie. And they're just, I mean, they command the screen. Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix are just ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's really funny that you mentioned that this seems like it's just so much weirder than There Will Be Blood, because it is. There Will Be Blood is so... It's very much a prestige genre, and I mean, we'll talk about it in a few weeks, but I feel like The Master's more in line with PTA's other movies, though, and the feeling that you get in those movies, right? In things like Punch Drunk Love, even like Boogie Nights, like this feels more in line as a PTA movie than just this high drama. And I think the opening of this movie couldn't turn a lot of people off of it. It's weird. It's weird cuts. You have Joaquin Phoenix humping a sand mermaid. Like, it's weird. It's weird, and it doesn't tell you. Or it tells you right away that it's weird. And then we get the stuff in the department store with him being a photographer, and we kind of just see that he doesn't fit into life. Like, PTA sets up this character of Freddy so well because he introduces us to this very disturbed man, this man who is... He's been through things. He doesn't seem to be out there. He lets his emotions get the best of him. And they show him as a sailor, and then they show him in therapy. Like, how many times do we get that in a film, right? Where we're in the first 10 minutes of this movie, we know exactly who Freddy is. And we can tell right away that he's like sex obsessed. And it's really interesting as we go through this film and we follow this character, and he gets less sex obsessed as he's, you know, clinging on to the master. And that's something people don't like talking about, right? Like, we talked about it all the way at the beginning of this podcast. We were talking about shame and sex addiction, right? Like, people don't like talking about that type of thing. So it's really makes it a little harder for people to talk about. And I think PTA does it in such a beautiful way here, because he's presenting it in a way where, you know, you don't get the NC-17 rating in this movie. You just get the R. And it's just so hard for the general population to accept that type of movie, which is a shame, because like Jordan Alford said in the comments, this is the best film of the 2010s.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I disagree, you know, because I didn't even mention The Impossible, which also came out that year. 2012 was a really good year for movies. Just the wrong movies were nominated. The Master, people struggle with this because think about what PTA's done, right? He made Boogie Nights, which is about porn. And people loved it because it was done in such a lighthearted way. Then he makes Magnolia, which was a box office success with all of the weirdness in that. There's a lot of weird sexual relationships with that. It is hinted that the man has sex with his daughter, or at least sexually assaulted his daughter in some way, shape, or form. He assaulted her. That is hinted at, while Julianne Moore is 50, 60, 70 years younger than the guy who is dying on his deathbed. And we're seeing a lot of weird sex kind of stuff. But this one was almost too realistic for people. This movie was one of his very few box office bombs. Like, it was a bad – it did very poorly at the box office. And, like – was it the subject matter? Because I understand that this isn't a direct thing at L. Ron Hubbard. Like, it's not directly going at L. Ron Hubbard. But people seem to be fascinated with Scientology and those types of, like, cultish, religious, whatevers. So why was there no fascination with this premise? I mean, it's so expertly done, and Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, the master, as it just keeps going and going and going, I'm surprised that people didn't latch onto at least his character more. Mm-hmm. But maybe it was too dark. This was also, obviously, There Will Be Blood has an epic score behind it, right? I mean, nobody's going to deny that. But prior to that, Paul Thomas Anderson's movies tended to have really good soundtracks, right? Like Hard Eight has a pretty good one. Boogie Nights obviously is one of the best of all time. Magnolia has a very good one with all the Amy Mann stuff. Punch Drunk Love, I don't remember much, but I definitely know it was there. And then There Will Be Blood was a little bit of a change. This movie's score is more of like a horror movie score. And I almost wonder if people were just turned off by like what the subject matter was, the fact that it really wasn't, it didn't feel like a PTA movie at the time. But since this movie was made, really since There Will Be Blood was made, PTA did a total change on what his style was. But Phantom Thread is just like this movie. I mean, it's just like he very much follows this style still. So might have been one of the most impactful movies of his career. He claims it's his favorite movie he ever made. He likes it more than There Will Be Blood. So there you go.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the score, because I mean, Johnny Greenwood's score in this movie is absolutely incredible. It's spectacular. And I didn't think about it in the horror movie vibes, but it does. It does have those type of, you know, those grating sounds, the contrast to everything. Johnny Greenwood, for those who don't know, Johnny Greenwood of Radiohead, scores like almost every Paul Thomas Anderson movie now. And he brings in that kind of experimental music that Radiohead was getting into right before There Will Be Blood and everything, like that middle career of Radiohead. And the way his music punctuates every scene in here, it's so subtle. It's a very subtle score. But when it's very present, you really realize it. And then it makes you think more about what is this relationship between PTA and Johnny Greenwood, and how are they showing it together through image and through sound. And it just elevates the entire thing. I swear I wrote a note down about this.
Uh-oh. This is what happens when you try to write.
We talked about it before the podcast, too. And now, of course, it's me falling flat in my face with it, right?
I know. John literally said, I write notes so that I don't have to have the ums. And here he is,
I know. Way through that. I remember what it was. And it's the sequence while they're on the boat. And you're like, we get all those long shots of the sea and everything. And we have Johnny Greenwood using a whole tone scale in the composition. And it's very reminiscent of Debussy and Le Maire, right? And it like, it just captures that surrealness of that scene as Freddy's kind of like navigating his way around the boat right before, and it leads into the processing scene afterwards. And it gives that surrealism of everything that's going on. And then it's brought into this scene where it's the most real the movie ever gets.
Yeah. I love that. And that scene, does that scene have any music in it or no?
No.
It doesn't, right? Yeah, it's just all acting. Yeah, it's crazy. Like, that's where Philip Seymour Hoffman – I actually think Philip Seymour Hoffman's better in this movie than Joaquin Phoenix. And I know a lot of people are like, oh, Joaquin's great. Joaquin's great, but a lot of Joaquin's – what makes his a little bit better is the physical nature of it, because he's hunched. And what I mean, it looks brutal. But people underestimate how good Philip Seymour Hoffman's composure and stance and everything is in this movie. The confidence he exudes when in reality he has no confidence is crazy. And in that scene especially, once he gets laughed at one time, I want to fart right now. Like, whatever he says, and he realizes Freddie's not taking this seriously. He can't handle that. And you see those little subtle changes of just like, you know what? This is a waste of my time. This isn't the guy. And then Freddie says, no, I got to do this. I got to do this. And it's like, okay, fine, let's do this. That performance there, and then it's followed up not long after by Lancaster Dodd going at the critic.
Yeah.
And that's when he calls him a pig fuck. And after he's trying to answer. It's brilliant. And before that, we have him walking down the aisle, shaking hands, patting backs, whatever. Like, to watch, if you watch just scene by scene, only the scenes that Philip Seymour Hoffman were in, and you said this one came, and then this one came, and then this one came, he changes so significantly in every single scene. Every single one. And, yeah, I mean, look, that processing scene might be the best. When I rewatched this movie this time, I thought the ripping of the critic was the best. I mean, just excuse me. Like, it's just, it's unbelievable. And to see him lose his cool in front of all of his followers who are praising him and he could do no wrong and blah, blah. It's beautiful. Like, it's just so incredibly well done. But yeah, I got away a little bit from what you were saying, but it's like when it's all working together, this movie has like such a sophistication to it that so many movies don't have. And maybe that's not your thing. I mean, I get it. Film is supposed to be about entertainment, right? Mm-hmm. But there is something so crisp and so precise about every single decision that is made. You almost feel like you're watching a documentary about this man allowing himself to join a cult without even realizing that he's joining a cult.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what really makes this relationship work between Freddie and Edmond Gessardot is the fact that it's a codependent relationship. Mm-hmm. And you don't see that for a long time. You don't see how dependent Dodd is to Freddie and why he needs him around all the time. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes like the pick a point game that they play.
Oh, it's
like
great.
It makes that so impactful because like it's at that point where you realize Dodd so needs Freddy, but he needs to like let him go in order to succeed, right? Because we already saw that, you know, he was drinking Freddy's hooch and stuff, so that didn't go well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just incredible to see this broken relationship of these two people repairing each other in a way where Rami Malek's character says it, right? Where I don't think Freddy's as committed to the cause as the cause is to him. And it's that dichotomy between these two characters that it almost brings out that questioning that Dodd has in himself. And like, is everyone trust me to trust everything I say? But when book two comes out, he has to change the way things work because he's like, now people aren't trusting me as much. How do I get more people to trust me?
How do I get more, right? Because that's always what the religious cultish type things are. And, you know, I'm not saying religion's a cult. I'm saying, but when you start to have these types of things that just pop up and trust me, this will be about man. It came to me like, it's always about how do we expand to whoever? And he preys upon the weak-minded. And once the weak-minded start to question him, it shows how weak-minded he is.
Yeah.
This with Laura Dern, where she says it used to be recall and now it's imagine. You can see in that scene, he doesn't realize he did that.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't realize that that's what he wrote, which does go to the L. Ron Hubbard thing a little bit, because L. Ron Hubbard wrote so much with science fiction that there'd be things that contradicted. And people always say, I mean, if you ever watch Going Clear or anything like that, they talk about how all of a sudden you get to the next book and you're like, what the hell is this? This doesn't even make sense. When she questions him and he can't take it and he just screams at her, that's what it is. Like, it's that losing control almost because he allowed himself to believe too much in this Freddie Quell guy because he's desperate for somebody who is just going to follow him like a dog into whatever.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what we see Freddie doing the entire time, right? After the scene with the critic, Freddie goes and beats him up because that's what Freddie knows. And I think that's what makes people question whether or not Freddie is actually involved in this cause. Even I think it's safe to say Freddie isn't in this cause at all. He is only here because of Lawrence Dodd and because of the connection he has grown with him. There are moments where Freddie feels at peace, but every time he gets cornered, every time he doesn't understand something, he goes back to aggression.
Yeah.
It's like when the police show up to arrest Dodd. It's like when it's the wall and window scene.
Yeah.
Right? He gets so angry, so aggressive. And he seems... There's only two sides to Freddy, really. There's the anger and there's the apathy. And that's it. There's nothing in between, which is what makes Joaquin Phoenix's performance so incredible, because it's hard not to play the in-betweens.
Yeah. When does he lose... I'm trying to think. So on Freddy's turn, Freddy drives off at high speed and disappears. Mm-hmm. So it's after he beats up the book publisher.
Yes.
Straight line on Dodd's motorcycle. Yeah. And then he drives away.
Yes. And then he goes to check in on Doris.
And then he goes to check in on Doris. It's after the Doris moment that we see his anger actually start to go away.
Yes.
Because at the end of the movie, he's no longer angry. And you were getting at, it's like the whole sexual aggression, whatever type thing. It's almost like he's allowing himself to move past that. Now, at the end of the movie, I think it's such a brilliant scene. He's having sex with a woman, and he starts doing the processing on her. And part of me is like, is he now the shepherd for Dodd? Who's going around and actually trying to bring people into this cult?
Yeah.
Is that what he's doing? Because we see that it doesn't, we don't see how their conversation ends. We just see it end and then he goes. And part of me is like, that's his purpose now. And I hadn't really thought about that until I watched it this time. Before that, I just thought like, oh, he had nothing, whatever. He's like lost. I almost feel like going through everything he went through with Lancaster Dodd and the anger and everything like that allowed him to come to terms with holding on to Doris and how angry the Doris situation made him. And now he's actually ready to follow what the master is doing and like become pretty much the next guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's so pivotal that like that Dodd says beforehand, for if you find a way to live without a master, what the rest of us know.
Yeah.
There's that idea that we all have this master that we have to follow, that we apprentice under. And like, it's the master in many different ways, right? Like someone you apprentice under, somebody you slave for. It's just these different terms of master that play so well here. And to see that final scene where, again, Dodd says, if we meet again in the next life, we'll be mortal enemies. Like, it just goes to show the relationship between these two and how it's evolved throughout the process of this film. But they still are so codependent of each other that even in the next life, Dodd knows that if there is another life, that the two of them will be drawn together.
Yeah. 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 It was just so much fun to think about. Like, I love that whole idea of like, we keep on, I recognize you from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And it's those little things that make Lancaster Dodd all the more impactful, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, I recognize you from somewhere. I recognize you from somewhere. But Jordan Alford says, I think Freddie did find a way to live without a master. Maybe his master really the entire time was Doris and whatever he was feeling for her and whatever he was feeling for, you know, whatever sexual urges she brought out of him. And he was finally able to put that away because of everything he learned from Lancaster Dodd. And now he is living without a master. I mean, I don't know, but I think that's what makes the movie so damn good, is that it leaves you with like kind of that dark, but potentially good ending.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it really depends. I think everyone who watches this movie is going to have a different interpretation of it. And it's really going to hit them differently. I think some people are going to feel like it's a totally depressing ending, because it kind of is. I think some people are going to be like, oh, it's a happy ending. And I think a lot of people are just going to go, I don't know what just happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I think is what happened the first time a lot of people watched this movie, which is why the word of mouth on it wasn't very good. Yep. And I mean, I liked this movie, but I did find it the first time I watched it. I definitely thought it was disappointing compared to There Will Be Blood and the fact that I already loved Boogie Nights and Magnolia. So that definitely did feel like a bit of a, oh, that sucks. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't really hit me the way that I wanted it to. And then it was followed up by what I think is the only letdown that Paul Thomas Anderson has ever had. And that was Inherent Vice.
Yeah.
Which came out the next year or 2 years later. And all of a sudden it was like, okay, now because Inherent Vice wasn't that good, people weren't going back and saying, well, let me give The Master another chance. Mm-hmm. Instead, it was Paul Thomas Anderson's washed up. Let's move on. And then Phantom Thread comes out, and all of a sudden it's like, well, maybe Inherent Vice wasn't that bad. And then he follows up with Licorice Pizza, and now Licorice Pizza and Phantom Thread kind of get watched, whereas Inherent Vice and The Master have kind of fallen by the way of Punch Drunk Love. Mm-hmm. We're just like, oh, yeah, that happened. The Master definitely gets more love now than Inherent Vice, but still very interesting how, like, when one movie leads into another, how it can impact how a movie is viewed. Because of how good There Will Be Blood was, The Master seemed like a disappointment. Inherent Vice doesn't do what it needs to do, and The Master kind of gets forgotten. It's surrounded by the best movie PTA has ever made, maybe. I don't think so, but maybe. And the worst movie he's ever made, maybe. And so where does it fall? It gets lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and absolutely. It shouldn't. This is you have to watch this just for the performances. And I mean, we spent this entire time talking about Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman, but there are some other very strong performances in this movie as well. And the supporting cast is, like, pretty stacked, actually.
Best performance of Rami Malek's career by far. Jesse Plemons is great. Amy Adams always is great. Laura Dern's obviously very good. But yeah, there's a lot of good bit parts in this movie for sure.
Yeah.
And yeah, actually, I'm looking at it now. It's funny. Everything. So There Will Be Blood gets made for $25 million, makes $76 million. I'm just looking at this now, and then we can move on. Punch Drunk Love, it made pretty much, it was 25 budget, 24.7, whatever. Magnolia, $37 million budget, box office, 48.5. And this is just domestic box office, so this doesn't get anything else. Boogie Nights, $15 million budget, $43 million box office. Again, this is just domestic. But then The Master goes $32 million budget, box office, 28.3. Since The Master, he has not had a movie make back its budget.
Really?
Inherent Vice did not. Licorice Pizza did not. And Phantom Thread. Oh, Phantom Thread. Did Phantom Thread? Phantom Thread did make back. So Phantom Thread was $35 million, box office, 47.8. But Paul Thomas Anderson was a bona fide box office success. We talk about with David Fincher. David Fincher makes great movies that don't make money. Paul Thomas Anderson made great movies that made money.
Yeah.
And it's funny because later in his career, as I think he's put out some of his best work. I mean, every movie he's made pretty much other than Inherent Vice and Heart Eight is whatever, Punch Drunk Love is whatever. But those other seven movies, whatever, they're really good. Yeah. At least really good. And he's just kind of getting shrugged at a little bit by audiences who have lost a little bit of faith in him since There Will Be Blood.
Yeah.
Which is now 16 years old.
Yeah.
Old enough to date Freddie Quell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah. It's crazy. Anything else you want to add other than that Seymour Hoffman was robbed at gunpoint in this movie?
I mean, I just have to believe the Academy didn't even watch this movie for him not to win.
Well, this was the year where they admitted to not watching The Impossible and this because they were too, like, disturbing of movies. So it makes sense.
Yeah.
It would absolutely make sense. Yeah, Philip Seymour Hoffman, it's just like every time you watch him in anything, it's just so much sadder, like what happened in his life. Just absolutely devastating. But all right, anyway. What do you got as your best movie that you watch this week?
It also stars Joaquin Phoenix. It's Beau Is Afraid. I went and saw it on Friday, and I'm still not 100% sure. I know I loved it, but I'm not sure how much I loved it. Mm-hmm. It Ari Aster brings, it won't be considered a horror movie, but if you do see this movie and don't think it's a horror movie, just remember your heart palpitations and how much stress you feel throughout the movie, and you'll realize it's a horror movie. Ari Aster goes all out with this one. Like, this is a movie, this feels like the movie of someone who's like, I have always wanted to make this movie, but no one would let me make this movie until I made two successful movies first.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you can't be prepared for this movie. I want to watch it again to see how I feel about it, but I'm not prepared to watch it again. And I don't know how long it'll take me to be prepared.
Yeah, I'm going to check it out. It's not playing by me yet. Living in Florida, you don't get shit down here until it's things are in mid-run. Mine was From Russia with Love. Obviously, a short week, didn't watch much, but I did a double feature on Thursday night. Yeah, Thursday night, I did a double feature of John Wick 1 and From Russia with Love, and that was one hell of a double feature. That was a great double feature. From Russia with Love is such a great movie because it's not a Bond movie at all. It has all the great things a Bond needs. It has the one-liners. It has like all that fun stuff. But it's such a normal spy movie.
Yeah.
And it's actually like at times a little difficult to follow like what's actually going on, which is not how Bond movies are supposed to be. It's such a great one. It's my favorite Connery one. But yeah, that was fun. Anyway, let's do The Graduate, which, John, you hadn't seen before this top 100, right?
That's right. When I made my list, I had seen it. I've seen it three times since we started this list.
There you go. So The Graduate was one of those movies that you grow up with a dad who was born in the 1960s. You hear how great The Graduate is all the time because it came out in the 60s. And, like, you know, that's like their, like, you know, that's the movie. And I remember the first time I watched it, I really didn't get it. I was like, whatever, like, he's trying to seduce her. Ha, ha, ha. Like, or she's trying to seduce him. Like, what the hell does it matter? And then as I got older, it's one of those movies that just rings true. And it's funny because when I was in college, we watched this movie for one of my classes. And I remember the professor I had, which tells you how worthwhile college is, hated this movie. Like, would just, there was a guy who was like part of the program who was one of the other like student teachers or whatever, who like wrote paper after paper about how amazing this movie was and the impact it had on society and blah, blah, blah. And my teacher just thought the movie was like a piece of shit. And I'm like, okay, great. Like, thank you for teaching me your ways of thinking great movies are pieces of shit. Like, don't go to school for film. PTA, we just talked about him. That's what he would tell you. But it was funny because when we watched it in 2011 or 12, whatever it was like The Graduate had gone through this thing where it was no longer great, right? Like in 1997, it was the seventh greatest movie of all time by AFI. It drops to 17 in 2007. And all of a sudden that meant it had lost its luster. Roger Ebert had once given it 4 stars and then went back on it and said it didn't age well and blah, blah, blah. And once somebody says something, as we learn living in the age of social media, that starts to become what people just parrot even when they don't watch it, or they watch it and they say, yeah, that didn't age well. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. Nobody thinks for themselves anymore. So that became the thing with The Graduate. And I remember watching it in college and being like, that didn't age well, huh? Like, yeah, okay, what didn't age well about that? Because, like, I remember going into that movie, the discussion was like, you guys might not get everything that's going on because of this, that, whatever. I'm like, what is there to not get about the movie? But then what was funny was the older I've gotten and the more removed from college. So you watch it in college, it's a great movie, and you're like, that's one of the best movies ever. Then you leave college, and it suddenly becomes the most important movie in your life, right? Because you're like, holy shit, I understand. But as you keep drifting further and further away, you realize how much more this movie is saying than just about a guy who's worried about his future. Benjamin Braddock isn't just Benjamin Braddock. Benjamin Braddock is every boomer who is trying to overcome their white collar, unhappy families who are pretending to be happy, doing all this stuff. Like, the opening moments of dialogue of this movie. Benjamin, what's going on with you? I'm worried. What are you worried about? I'm about my future. What are you worried about your future? Well, I want it to be different.
Mm-hmm.
And if that doesn't define what we see with the revolution from 1967 through like 1980, with everything that went on with Vietnam and just the 70s as a whole, the whole hippie, everything. And it's being told from the point of view of arguably one of the most ordinary upper middle class slash wealthy children that you could ask for. There's mm-hmm. nothing counterculture. This isn't Peter Fonda riding on a motorcycle around the American West in Easy Rider 2 years later. This isn't Midnight Cowboy, which came out 2 years later. This isn't whatever you would see with A Clockwork Orange, which came out 4 years later. This wasn't Space Odyssey, which came out the next year. This was a guy that looked just like you or mm-hmm. looked just like your friends who went to college at that time. And they made this movie that is just it. This, like I talk about, like, I think Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is the most important movie of our generation. Mm-hmm. I think this movie defined 1960s film.
Yep.
And it might define 1970s film. The 70s is probably the greatest decade in film history. But this movie paved the way for all of those movies that were a little bit edgier than what we were watching come out in the 1960s. And it's done with a comedy about a guy who sleeps with an older woman. Which, by the way, Anne Bancroft's 35 years old during filming of this. So.
Really?
Yeah. They put a lot of freaking makeup.
Wow.
Yeah, she's 35 years old during filming, and Dustin Hoffman was 29. But anyway, I digress. What do you got?
It's really funny that this movie is often classified as a comedy because I think it's one of the most depressing movies I've ever seen.
Yeah. Hey, man, that's like Moonrise last week.
I know. And it's so real. And Dustin Hoffman's performance is so real. And it's just that idea that, like, every person at some point in their life will feel like Benjamin Braddock does.
Mm-hmm.
You might deny it. You might look at yourself and say, I've never felt like that. Well, I've got some bad news for you listeners. You're going to.
Yeah.
It's come. Because at some point in your life, you just look at yourself and you're like, what am I doing? And you have everyone else around you asking, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
And it always comes after everyone's so excited about what you're going to be doing. And I watched this movie with my roommate who had never seen it before this week. And he was talking about how, like, Ben's kind of creepy, especially when we get to the end of this film. I was like, yeah, he is. But you also have to realize that, like, these are two people with him and Elaine who finally found someone they connected with, someone who they felt genuine around, and the entire world was working against them having that moment mm-hmm. and having that ability to have that, share that, because this movie is all about that emptiness inside you when you don't know what's going on, and then finding something that finally fills it and having it ripped away from you. And, like, it's done in a way that is so enjoyable and so rewatchable that it's impossible to not say this is one of the best movies ever made.
Well, and so one of the criticisms of this movie, and this is like where I go into my political spiel, because I can't help myself, because we're so sensitive right now mm-hmm. that, like, anytime any, like, buddy farts incorrectly, we have to be like, oh my yeah. God, you just, like, I'm gonna cry about it for hours and hours and put it on social media so people will feel bad for me, and I'm gonna try to start a cause. One of the big criticisms of this movie is Catherine Ross's character of Elaine is falling for this creep for no reason. It's total nonsense. He slept with her mother. And then you get the big reveal later on that Mrs. Robinson claims Benjamin raped her. And Elaine is still sitting there letting him explain himself and then goes back to the room and says, kiss me, Benjamin. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how the hell could this happen? This is despicable, blah, blah, blah. That's why this movie is so important, and that's why this movie is so perfect, is because in 1967, what your parents said, what your parents did, is what controlled your life, right? It was all about control. You didn't curse back at your parents. You didn't talk back to you. If you did, you got the shit kicked out of you, because that's what people did back then. Like, that's, it was all so much about like the fear of the, your matriarchal, patriarchal family. It was all patriarchal. Who the hell am I kidding? But it was all about that. And you're watching these super depressed people, Mrs. and Mr. Robinson. We don't even hear their first names, but they're so unhappy with the relationships they're in. Right? They're so unhappy. All the old people are unhappy. All they're talking about is, what are the youth going to do and how can we kind of navigate it? And this is the way that this goes, the extremity one after the other in this movie elevates this, because only after the most controlling thing your parents could do, sleep with this guy, like the mom is sleeping with this guy. How could you ever overcome that? That is how this society felt. Mm-hmm. It felt like, how can I ever totally relate to the people of my generation and make it make sense to the other people when they're so overly controlling and just taking me apart one by one? And like, my life has already been planned for me. Now I have to get married. All of the shotgun wedding aspects of this movie, people look at it and they're like, that wouldn't have. That's what it was like in the 60s. It was like, great, we slept together once. We better hurry up and get married so that God doesn't smite us. Mm-hmm. I love what they do with this character, because it shows in the Elaine character how helpless the women of this era, the young women of this era, felt. They felt so helpless. And they would find the one thing, the one person who they truly connected with, and it would be, okay, what's wrong with them? And rather than having Benjamin Braddock be James Dean, right? Be this edgy guy who's a rebel and like all that. They made him a huge dork. A huge dork. And it was like, man, she needs to somehow put all of this aside just to overthrow her parents. And it leads to one of the most depressing endings of all time. Which is, okay, we just did all this, but where the hell are we going? What have we truly done? But that's how the generation felt, right? Mm-hmm. That's why you look, what, that generation is the highest rate of divorce ever, because they stopped being God-fearing people, but they stopped being it too late, after they'd already done what their parents had told them they had to do, after what society had told them they had to do. And this movie was kind of getting ahead of that curve, and it was saying to you, what are we doing? Like, what the hell are we doing? So I think the Catherine Ross character is phenomenal in this. And I think it's so hugely important how she is portrayed and how much is against her for her to still have the autonomy to say, you know what? I still feel something for you.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, but it needs to be that ridiculous.
Is it? I don't even think it's that ridiculous, because one of the big themes in this film, and I mean, maybe people disagree with me, but I think one of the big themes here is that intergenerational relationship. And it's a theme that comes up in almost anything, right? It happened in Moonrise Kingdom last week. Like, it happens all the time. It's one of arts and literature's and film's greatest themes to dissect, because there's always this fear that you'll become your parents.
Yeah.
Right. And in this film, we see it. We see it manifesting, because we see how excited the Braddocks are that Ben's graduated and, like, you know, he's going to be successful. They reward him with the Alfa Romeo and they give him the tuba diving suit and stuff. And then as the movie progresses, they're getting ticked off. What are you doing just lying around here? What are you doing? What are you going to do? Have you even thought about graduate school? What's the point of even getting a degree if you don't go to graduate school? Let me tell you. Great question.
Yeah. What's the point of even going to graduate school at this point, John?
Yeah.
I don't know. I went.
I don't know. And it's that tension between the generations. It's the fact that Mrs. Robinson isn't getting along with her husband because she's been, you know, she was forced into the marriage. Mm-hmm. They never got along with each other. How does she try to escape it? With someone in a different generation.
Yeah.
It's that whole idea of it all. It's someone who's her daughter's peer, right? Like
someone she's known her whole life.
Yeah, right. No, more importantly, someone she's known his entire life.
Yeah, that's the line. That's the line. Thank you.
And you get that tension in this, and that's what makes it seem. I think when you're younger, you're looking at this, and you're like, okay, this woman's just coming out to this guy like that. That's a pretty big deal and stuff. And then as you get older and you watch it more, you realize, I don't want to say it's sad, but how I guess depressing is just the word we have to go back to here. It's depressing that the only escape Mrs. Robinson has is this affair with Ben.
Yeah. Yeah, and Jordan says here, it's a film about generational curses and how they act. The act of trying to break them can just make new ones or make them worse. That is such a perfect description of this movie. Because I say this to people all the time, right? Like everybody who's living right now, no matter what your belief system is, you think your belief system is right. You think the way you think about all the hot button topics around the world, the country, wherever you live, you think that your belief system is right and the people who are opposing you are wrong. And what makes me laugh is a lot of people hate the boomers now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like we look back and we're like, oh, go home, boomer, right? Like, I mean, I remember that there was like the Harvard football game where the kids like sat in the middle of the game and like did like a whatever and they're screaming, go home, boomer. If it wasn't for the boomers, you wouldn't be sitting in the middle of the field at Harvard. Because they taught you how to do the peaceful sit-in. like, get me out of here. But it's this whole thing of every generation tries to do better than the previous generation. And they're right about 75% of what they're doing. But the 25% of what they're wrong about is what the next generation clings on to try to change.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, it's why each generation keeps hating the generation that precedes them or follows them or whatever. And I always say to my friends, I'm like, you might think you're doing great now. Kids that are born today are going to hate you in 30 years. They are going to despise you because they're going to be like, how the hell did you do this to my country? How did you do this to my world? How did you do this? It doesn't matter what you think. That's what they're going to say because that's just kind of how this intergenerational stuff works. It's very hard to appreciate everything your parents have done. Because you see all your parents' flaws. You see all of the other adults' flaws. And you say to yourself, I don't want to be that. I want to be different. And The Graduate says everything so plainly the whole movie. I want to be different. You're trying to seduce me. The only character who speaks in tongues this entire movie is Mrs. Robinson during the initial seduction scene where she won't say exactly what she wants. After that, everything that is said in the rest of the movie is exactly what's happening. And like, there's just that boldness to the script by Buck Henry that is willing to go there and willing to just talk about these heavy topics and do it in a lighthearted, but also dark way that still resonates today. Cause even if you don't sit here and you're not like, oh, I'm just drifting through life. Every person, every generation, whatever, you're going to have that moment. You're going to be like, I feel like I'm just drifting. I feel like I'm just going somewhere. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what comes next. But like you said, people are going to be asking. Older people are going to be asking. Your peers are going to be asking. You know, but we're all going to have that. So even if you don't grasp on to everything from The Graduate, Benjamin Braddock, Elaine, the Robinsons, and the Braddocks, they are all characters that still exist all over the place today.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're from a wealthy white family or a poor black family or a middle-class Hispanic family, it doesn't matter. Most of the families that exist in like Europe or America or whatever, you're going to be able to see these people when you go around. Like I'm talking in Western civilization. You're going to be able to see these people when you go around. And that's what's fascinating about this movie. For as much as people change, I'm going to be different than that generation. I look at my parents and I'm like, they're just like the Robinsons. And they were born 5 years before this movie came out. But they're so similar. When I got done with college, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? It's almost like you wasted our money. You wasted everybody's money. You wasted everybody's time. What are you doing? Come on. But you sit there and you're like, what am I supposed to do? Like, what are we supposed to do?
Yep.
This movie captures that feeling of your early 20s better than any other movie ever will. But it also captures how these people in their mid-40s, now it might be closer to like 50, but how you feel when you're like, my life has gotten away from me. I don't have happiness anymore. What am I supposed to do? It asks that question.
It asks it. And like, I think part of what makes this film so good is that it doesn't answer that question.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Because it asks the audience that, and it's like, we don't have an answer for you because it's going to be different for every single person who watches this movie. And you can see, like, I mean, you get to the end of this movie and you realize how depressing it really is, and you see the regret. I mean, the facial acting in that last on that bus scene is top notch. It's incredible. You just see that like sinking feeling of realization in both of these people of like, what do we do now? And it's just like that cycle of what we've seen in the entire movie of, okay, we've taken this next step. Now what? That society is just pouring onto us all the time. I think one of the most pivotal scenes in this entire movie is the one where Ben asks Mrs. Robinson to have a conversation.
Yeah.
And because like that's it's the turning point in the movie, right? It's where Ben kind of realizes what's going on with Mrs. Robinson. It's when the audience gets to figure out what's going on with Mrs. Robinson. We get an idea. And yeah, maybe that's what's aged poorly, is the way Mrs. Robinson is talking about everything, and that entire conversation doesn't pertain as much to society now. But like,
I think it does. But anyway,
I mean, it does. It does. But I mean, the pregnancy and having like being forced to get married isn't as prevalent as it was back then, for sure. And but that conversation, and it's the fact that like she suggests talking about art, says she doesn't know anything about art, and then she has a degree in art, right? Like now we're just critiquing post-secondary, which happens a lot. A lot of people, pretty film, man. And all of that bundled together in that one small conversation, it's Ben realizing he doesn't want to become Mrs. Robinson.
Yeah. He didn't want to become his parents, and now he's realizing that he is having an affair with a woman who is wholly uninteresting to him.
Mm-hmm.
She's providing him nothing. She's providing him nothing in his life. And then when they do try to have a conversation, it's just depressing.
Yeah.
And like, I love that scene. I love the we always talk about like the bone being thrown in the air in Space Odyssey as like the greatest cut of all time. And by we, I mean me. The cut from him going underwater and going up on the raft, and it cuts to him landing on top of her.
Yeah.
Like second to none. That is just brilliance. And it's just showing this, I have nothing left. And what happens when he takes Elaine out? They're laughing. They're having a good time. They're talking. And I had said it earlier, everybody kind of says what they want and what they're doing in this movie. They might not always like say it right away, but like when Benjamin takes Elaine out, we know it's because he's scared of Mrs. Robinson. So he takes her to the strip club. Then he feels so bad and he starts to do whatever he can. And then they hit it off and they do really well. The only character who's not saying everything that they want is Mrs. Robinson in the seduction scene. And it's because of the disconnect between these characters, because she can't just come out and say, I want to sleep with you right now. Because there's that societal feeling of, how could you do this? Mr. Robinson, you're married. You have a daughter. You're this, you're that. She doesn't care. But there's that societal disconnect that doesn't allow them to talk. And when they try to talk, they have nothing in common. There's nothing there. And like, this movie just so brilliantly portrays that through all of these scenes and all of the interactions. Ben can't talk to his parents anymore because all they're doing is nagging on him about how he's doing nothing in his life. But he can't tell them why he's doing nothing in his life. But we also see that he doesn't really have peers around. He doesn't have drinking buddies. He doesn't have that, which I think is kind of like what the crux of the wealthy right? Where like you live such an insulated life sometimes that you don't actually like get out and talk. Although I do think generationally too, like the 60s, you're not doing as much of the, you have the boys from the street, but like, I think, you know, I mean, granted, I family members are closer to 70 and stuff, but they might have like one childhood friend they still talk to. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of crazy because now we're so interconnected. It's almost like, how did you lose contact with everybody? But nobody in Benjamin Braddock's circle understands him. But nobody in Mrs. Robinson's circle understands her.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's that tension between these characters. It's just how same, it's how the same the characters are, all of the characters in this movie. And that's, I mean, that's one of the saddest parts about this entire movie is that you just realize this is a movie full of very depressed people with no way out.
Mm-hmm. Because they're all living these happy, upper, you know, wealthy lives. And I say this all the time with movies, right? Like, I feel like some of the knocks on recent movies are always like, oh, it's a wealthy family or it's, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's such like, when we watch Lost in Translation, oh, he's so like, what, how could you not like, how are they so miserable? Because people are people.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are people. No matter what your situation is, you're always trained to want a better situation and always feel like there could be something better. That's just how people are.
One of the biggest things in opposition to this idea of like the wealthy as characters not garnering sympathy and empathy from audiences is that by making these characters wealthy, you're stripping away everything except for their personhood.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you're getting rid of every other obstacle that can impact them. And that's why something like The Graduate works so well, because with these upper, middle, lower, high, upper class citizens, you just have these people who are well off. Like, they can have whatever they want. There's nothing to prevent them from doing whatever they want, but they still have this paralysis from that, right?
Yeah.
And they don't have other obstacles like, you know, trying to feed themselves or paying rent every month, because you know what? That's even more sad because that's our lives.
Yeah.
And when you have these people, yes, it can be a bit of a disconnect for those who are not, don't get an affluent life like that. But when you strip it down to its bare bones, these are just humans. There are humans doing exactly what every other human does. And that's why this movie connects to everyone.
Yeah. Well, and The Graduate also is, it's showing that like wealthy life ain't that good. You might have all the money in the world, but that doesn't really mean anything. Like, it really doesn't mean anything, because eventually you're going to run out of, you're going to be bored with that too. You're going to just, whatever, I don't have anything. Like I said, it always feels like you have to want something more. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Robinson has this phenomenal life, right? But she doesn't have a phenomenal life. She has a lot of money, but it's always funny to me when it's like, money can't buy happiness, but I also don't want to watch these wealthy people because I don't feel bad for them. But if money can't buy happiness, then why should they be happy? Mm-hmm. I don't understand. Like, they're miserable. Like, they still have problems. They still have all this stuff going on. So I think The Graduate just really harnessed all of that, because like, this was the time where it was like six-figure job, you know, like it was like, if you made $100,000, I love the part where he says like, it's going to put me out $200. And it was like, whoa, like, even though like to us, I'm like, I spent $200 today. It's like, what are you talking about? But this was when it started to be like, you go to college and it meant something. It should have meant something. You're going to be a success. And what I love about the opening party of this movie, I know we're getting long on time, so we'll be done soon, but I love the opening part. It's very short. Mm-hmm. There's nobody Benjamin's age there. Nope. Everybody is old. And all they want to talk to him about is, what are you going to do next?
Yeah.
And it's like, why is that what you're curious about? Because they have nothing to look forward to. So they have to look back to look forward because they have nothing else. And then it goes to Mrs. Robinson, who's just like, just drive me home. Mm-hmm. And it's the power dynamic shifts in the Mrs. Robinson scene, where every time like she, like it seems like Ben's figured her out, she makes Ben feel like he's being foolish. The power dynamic shifts, the music that starts playing, all of that. One of the most brilliantly directed scenes of all time. Mm-hmm. And it's all in that first 15 minutes of this movie, because it goes from the party to that, to And it's just the power dynamic shifts. Every time Ben thinks he's getting the upper hand, she somehow finds a way to knock him down a peg. I love that. And I just had to make mention of both of those things. Nobody Ben's age is in either one of those scenes.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the direction, I love the scene, like the scuba gear scene.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's awkward, it's humiliating. When like Ben, you can feel that with him, but I think the most important shot in that entire scene is when we go down with Ben and we're in the pool and he's trying to surface and Mr. Braddock pushes him back down.
Yeah.
It's just such a metaphor for how suffocating parents and this older generation is to Ben in this film, and how they're constant, it's gonna sound bad, but like their constant affection and coddling of him is actually making things worse off for him. Because yeah. He feels like he's drowning.
It makes you feel like you're more of a failure. Because why aren't you? Like, look at how loving everything is. Blah, blah, blah. They're good. And that shot to obviously, you know, he gets in the family swimming pool. And then that last shot of him under the water is not in that same swimming pool. It's in a different swimming pool. Yeah. To do it from so far away and just keep drifting and drifting and drifting. The other shot that's like that is after he tells Elaine that he's sleeping with his mother. And they cut to the close-up of Mrs. Robinson's face. I don't think I've ever seen this done in a movie before or since. Cut to the close-up of Mrs. Robinson's face. And then they zoom out to show her standing in the corner completely alone, looking at Benjamin after he walks out the door. But to start closed in and then reveal how alone. And I don't think I've ever seen that done in a movie before or since. It's one of the best shots of the whole damn thing.
Absolutely. It's just this film's, as much as like the themes of this film really resonate well, they resonate so well because of Mike Nichols' direction.
Yeah. It's Mike Nichols' direction. It's the fact that Simon and Garfunkel are timeless. That helps.
That too. That really helps. I mean, we were talking about like best soundtracks in film. This is one of them.
This is one of them. Yeah. 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 It's unreal. What that kind of did too for the generation, right? Because it was just such there's even though they're so smooth, there's still a bit of an FU going on from Simon and Garfunkel. It's not Bob Dylan FU, but it's almost more of an FU to the older generation because it's so smooth.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the Beatles. They're not Elvis. They're not swinging their hips and doing whatever. It's very normal. It's not the Rolling Stones. It's very like, oh, that's nice sounding. And it's also kind of FU.
It's also super sad. Super very depressing. Sad. I mean, the opening credit sequence of this with the Sound of Silence playing as Ben's just like on the walking or on the moving sidewalk, you feel it immediately. You're just like, oh, this is bad. And then to bookend, to make another Simon Garfunkel reference, the film with Sound of Silence again, on the bus, like it's so beautiful and so haunting.
Yeah. Yeah. The Graduate's great. It keeps going for me. It did not age poorly. I don't care. Every critic in the world can say it aged poorly. They're all wrong. Like, critics are always wrong, but you're wrong. This movie did not age poorly. Anne Bancroft, one of the most iconic roles in film. Like, I know obviously now it's like, oh, well, what about like Captain Marvel or something like that? It's like, okay, like I'm talking like, yes, this was based on a book, but there was no other iteration. This is just one of the most iconic characters ever, female characters ever put to film.
Yep.
It really is. And like nowadays, obviously, like we've moved away. So it's like Princess Leia and like those types of female characters. But when Anne Bancroft played Mrs. Robinson in this movie in 1967, nobody had ever seen anything like it. Ever. Mm-hmm. Ever. It's just fantastic. And she didn't win the Oscar because they had to give it to Katharine Hepburn for the freaking 900th time. I've slowly discovered it with my love for film that Katharine Hepburn is probably the most overrated actress of all time, which is so funny because when you grow up with a love for film, you're told she's like the greatest actress of all time, mainly because she's won 4 Best Actress Oscars. And like her lineup is really good. And then you watch her movies and you're like, her lineup isn't that good. Like it's really not that good. And like she wins. I've never actually seen the movie and I want to, but she wins for Guess Who's Coming to Dinner over Anne Bancroft as Mrs. Robinson. And I just can't quite imagine after watching On Golden Pond and The African Queen, if she even won for the, I don't even remember. Yeah, it's bad. Katharine Hepburn is not good. I don't care what anybody says. And it makes me even more mad because she beats Anne Bancroft for this. But anyway, I digress. No need. Moving in number four next week, John. We got a month left of this podcast. That's it. We're going to be done by June. It's crazy. Number four next week. The Thing from 1982 and Amelie from 2001. Are you sure you don't mean The Thing from like 2015 or 14 or whatever it was?
It was 2011.
Was it? You sure you don't mean that one?
I certainly don't.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure. The Thing from 1982, Amelie from 2001. Two movies that couldn't be more different, but also they're so damn stylized. I can't wait to talk about them. It's been a while since I've talked Janae, so I'm very excited about that. John, did I miss anything? I know I just kind of like jumped into that.
So.
I looked up and I was like, holy shit, we're at an hour and 10.
No, I think we've covered most of it.
Yeah, we have 8 movies left, guys. That's it. Yep. 8 movies. So see you all then next week. It'll be on Wednesday. We're back to normal next week. So enjoy yourselves. And hope you're all liking this, because now we're at the best we can be. I'm glad, Jordan, you're back. Okay, now I'm going to move on.